From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
I've lived here all my life. Like, it's not a possibility that I could actually, you know, not even buy a place, but rent a place and be there long term.
Every woman on your show described my life for the last 12, 13 years.
And they really need mum's protection in order to be able to survive. So when they're taken away from their mother, they won't live for very long, unfortunately. It's very cruel, really.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily. Foul play. There's a duck napper at large in Dublin. How the property game is weighted against all singletons. And a big list of books that you can take with you on your definitely happening staycation this summer. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that 8 out of 10 ducks would recommend to a duck friend. Let's begin at the intersection of the day's news and the host's musings on said news. The newsings, if you will, from this morning's Ryan Tuberty show. And sympathy and relief for the barbers and hairdressers, many of whom reopened yesterday, as well as appreciation for our National Gallery.
I would imagine, given that every single programme I tuned into or turned on to last night and yesterday featured a barber or a hairdresser, that the hands and fingers of the hairdressers and barbers of Ireland are pretty tired this morning as they head in for round two. But I'd say it's a happy tired, because they were out the door yesterday. I know in my own barbershop, it was just keep going, keep going, keep going. Queue outside, get in there, back, wash, in, out, cut, cut, snip, snip, shave, shave, get out, next. And I say that in the most positive way. It was a great experience. Obviously, as a fella, it was very easy just to get a trim. I didn't go crazy. Just said, yeah, just neaten it up. And felt good. Came home. They said, yeah, it's like you before the COVID. I said, what was it like during the COVID? Just wasn't you, man. Wasn't you. And here we are. An element of normality. So much so that myself and my eldest, we went into the National Gallery of Ireland yesterday, having booked two e-tickets. Went in, no queue, no bother. Some lovely people. Some post-COVID, no, we're not post-COVID yet, but post-lockdown selfies in the art gallery, which was actually very welcome because it's a beautiful place to get pictures taken in anyway. And the place itself, you know, what you got to understand about the National Gallery of Ireland is it is teeming with soul-satisfying beauty. And more importantly is it's free. Everyone listening to this program can go in there now. And it'll cost you not one red cent. And I love that. I think that's a great thing about this country, is that culture and all these wonderful museums. Not all of them, but most of them are free of charge. And that is, what a great gift to citizens that you can do that. And you can go in and you can look at a Caravaggio and you can look at a Picasso and you look at the Laveries and the Yeatses, and you can look at Irish and European and Russian. And what they've done, if you haven't been there for years, go in, book it this week, go in next week, wait till the kids are off, make sure you have plans for the summer to come up from where you are around the country. Get in there, because it's so easy to get around, and you don't have to be, as the one guy, Tony, he's one of the fellas who kind of keeps an eye on the place. He said, can I show you the Vermeer? I said, hey, Tony, please do. Look at the Vermeer. And he gave me a history lesson on the Vermeer. And he showed me things I wouldn't have looked, because I would have passed by and gone, there's the Vermeer, tick. There's Picasso, tick. But he said, no, have a look at this Vermeer. I said, right, okay. So you see, because of see the letter on the ground? I said, well, I hadn't noticed that. Yeah, but she's just received the letter and she's annoyed. So she threw it in. And see the way she's at the top of the page with her pen, yeah? She's starting a letter to her lover who's obviously annoyed her. I said, okay, crikey. And see the way the light's coming? I said, yeah. So he said, now I've given you that little lesson on Vermeer. He said, now you can tell all your friends when you bring them in the next time and pass the information on, and you can look like an expert next time. I said, okay, good man. What a lovely thing to do. That was just one of the paintings. And the walls are painted a certain, like one of the halls has these dark, lush, red painted walls. I'm sure you've seen it if you haven't seen. And then there's a sort of turquoise color wall and teal. And they all pick up bits of the elements of the paintings that you're looking at that are hanging on the walls. Honestly, that's an open. And you know, like I said, for nearly 18 months, everything's going to taste, look and feel better. Well, the Art Gallery did. The National Gallery felt and tasted. I felt I was almost imbibing the artwork from the walls. So much so I'm going to go in again several times this summer, several times, because it just wasn't enough. I want to go back now and alight on a few of those pictures and spend more time and read more about them and go back in again. And as I say, free of charge. Beautiful.
And then the dawning realization that there's a duck thief at large.
Who's taking ducklings from the canal? Apart from the fact that the DSPCA have a spokeswoman called Gillian Bird, which of course the joke's right there, but she was excellent, by the way. And the fact that the head of Birdwatch Ireland is Niall Hatch. I mean, how does this happen? But anyway, I just say it every time, but it is extraordinary. But Gillian was saying that they're scooping the ducklings out and selling them to children for a fiver because they're great on TikTok or something like that. Question is, where are the adults? Like, allowing the children to buy a duckling for a fiver. I just don't. Thanks for the... Ducklings are pretty... Like, they're going to start going kind of crazy in your hand if you pick them up, I presume. And ducklings... Mama duck isn't going to take that lightly. I don't... It just sounds obscene, to be honest. I'm not making fun of it. I actually think it's disgusting. But where is somebody... Or if you saw it happening, would you be inclined to say... Lads, don't be doing that. Don't put the duckling back. Or do you just don't want to get involved? No, very bizarre. Very bizarre.
That's the word for it. Now, who wants an extra day off? Not as many people as you might think, apparently.
There was great chat I also heard on Drive Time last night about the potential to have a bank holiday, an extra bank, a one-off bank holiday. Did you hear about that? In the last Monday in September. And people were... the response to it was pretty, it was kind of, they were against it really from the texts that were coming in saying, well, we don't need another day off. It's bad for business. And I suppose it's not really bad for business if your business is tourism. And my feeling in it is, because I was listening to it going, okay, well, I'm weighing up the arguments here, but my feeling is I'm going to weigh in favour of an extra bank holiday. But what I would do is, as a compromise, I'd say we have an extra bank holiday and give it one go. So we do a COVID bank holiday once-off special next September and see how it goes. And if it's really bad for business, we'll say that wasn't once-off. If we find there's a lovely bounce from it, we'll say, let's go. Because little did I know, which I didn't, that the common number of bank holidays around Europe is about 11 or 12 in most European countries. I did not know this. In Ireland, we have, I think, 9 or 10 or thereabouts. And so we have scope for one more. So I'd say that every business I know that is a pub, restaurant, B&B could do with this. And I think they've suffered more than most. So my inclination is to say to them, the more support they can get, the better. And roll with that for once. Let's call it the COVID bank holiday special for everyone. Everyone needs a rest. Everyone's wrecked. Everyone who's been working, I should say, hard throughout it. And everyone who hasn't been working and is just drained from it all. Well, it could also do with this little special moment in September. So I'm a yes.
Ryan's a yes on an extra bank holiday for 2021. Are you? Now, if you're Marv Latte, August Marv Gane, you should probably stop listening right now.
If you like a cup of tea, which I do, I'd kill a coffee in the morning and then a tea later on. Very strong, tiny drop of milk, no messing. I see people with the white tea and I think, what? How can you enjoy that? That is like something that might give you in a hostage situation, you know. Anyway, that's for another day as well. But the IrishMirror.ie are reporting that a recent study has suggested that climate change could have an impact on the global supply of tea. So we could be in trouble here. It's an unwelcome piece of news for a nation of tea lovers. With global temperatures rising, resulting in more regular droughts, erratic rainfall and flash floods, the tea-growing regions of the world are taking a heavy toll. And among the most famous tea regions is Kenya, with erratic rainfall making floods and droughts more common. And with temperatures rising, there is a major threat facing tea plantations, which have been carefully cultivated over many years. Mother of God. Be careful of that.
From tea to the weather. Could this be any more Irish?
And if you are looking about worried about the rainfall in Kenya, just keep an eye on whatever app you're looking at, because the apps have mixed reaction, thanks to Adrian Weckler in the Irish Independent today. Well, the most popular weather app on iPhones and Android Irish app stores is Met Aaron's app. They are not the apps that come preloaded on smartphones. So that's why your smartphone app isn't getting the weather right, because they're preloaded. And generally, those apps take their data from US, from American feeds that are usually not quite as specific or focused as Irish forecasts. Adrian, thank you I see. So it's, and we're being told, yeah, it's going to rain in Connemara and Donegal. They don't know. They don't speak Irish weather. So you have to go to a more local, like a Met Aran app. He asks, why then do so many people rely on other weather maps? He's, one reason is that they're preloaded, yes. Another is ease of use. While Met Aran's app is functional, it's visually clunky and sometimes awkward to get to what you're looking for. A situation confirmed by its substantially lower App Store rating, which is 2.8 on the iPhone. Okay, so they need a little cleaning up on that one and then we'll be fine. But that does clarify that situation beautifully. So thank you for that.
That is where we leave Ryan Tuberty's musings from this morning's show. Are you not entertained? Oh, informed at least? Claire Byrne was joined by former Justice Minister Nora Owen, who yesterday urged the government not to forget the lessons learned as we emerge from lockdown restrictions and to work to make life better for carers and their families. Nora herself cared for her husband, who suffered from vascular dementia for 14 years until his death in November last year.
Eventually, at the 2 years before his death, we had to make the decision to put him into full-time care. So I have a fairly good experience of what it's like to be caring for somebody in your home and the changes that come about for somebody with dementia, but also other conditions as well. And in the government programme, I was glad to note that they put in they were going to set up a care commission, but it hasn't been established yet. And I think I just wanted to give a little prod to it that it needs to be established. I'm terrified that as we move into, you know, getting businesses opened again and getting people out and about, that some of the lessons we've learnt from the pandemic will get lost in the next part of the agenda, getting the country working
again. So where does this start for you? Is this that a carer in the home, somebody who's looking after a loved one themselves with some help from the HSE, that they're often forgotten? Is that your starting point?
Yes. I mean, it's estimated on a survey done in 2020 that over 500,000 people are providing care, and they can be range in age from 15 and 16 year olds right up to 80 and 85 year olds. And there is a carer's allowance, but there's quite strict rules as to whether you qualify. So there's a lot of people caring for a loved one who isn't getting any extra money for it, but they're doing their job, but at the same time they're full-time carers. And what happened with the start of the lockdown last March, a lot of the little respite centres that were available to give people a break and to give some activity for maybe somebody with dementia or other conditions, they all had to close down very quickly. Like we had started a little one here where I live in Malahide, where 10 people once a week got a few hours and their carers were able to go and have a swim or have their hair done or whatever it was they wanted to do. But we had to shut that down because the health board felt it wasn't safe to have people coming together like that, which it wasn't. And so that kind of help that was there has gone. So people who were getting care have certainly diminished their capacity during the last year, a year and a half nearly now.
We do know,
and
Nora, don't we?
I want to make sure that those services
get restored. Come back. But on the other side of this, though, there were an awful lot of additional home care hours signed off on and approved very quickly.
There were, but I'm a bit worried about that too. Now, I have no evidence to prove this, but I suspect that a lot of those hours didn't get taken up because, again, sending people into their homes, some people didn't want somebody coming into their home to help them, and therefore maybe some of those hours haven't been taken up, and I want to urge the government to make sure they don't get diminished, that those hours remain available, and as we all move back out into kind of a more open life, that those hours will be taken up by people and made available. But there's also, like in the government programme, they talk about setting up a basket of activity and services for people who are caring. Sometimes you need training if you're minding somebody. If somebody falls in the house and you can't pick them up? Who do you turn to? If somebody becomes unwell and a bit angry and aggressive, which very often happens with dementia and Alzheimer's, you know, you need support to help you to cope with that. What's the best way? I discovered things even myself that I did wrong, you know, like if we were going somewhere, I'd rush Brian and he wouldn't be able to cope with rushing. You had to start planning your outing an hour before you went out so that you had the shoes on and the clothes on. If I wanted Brian to have his shower, I had to nearly start talking about it and getting him ready for it because he just couldn't face the water flowing down on top of him. And that has happened. A lot of people have told me they have the same condition. So how do you help somebody who's caring for somebody when those kind of conditions come?
And so I want
to see that being done.
And the home care packages as well, you know, obviously it's a great help if you have someone coming in to give you a hand with the shower or with the lifting and so on. But you feel there should be a standardised level of home care right throughout the country?
Very much. I think they refer to it as a kind of the place where you live. You'll be lucky in some places, and in other places you just won't get it in the same kind of level. It's very important that if the HSE, which as I say have increased the number of hours, are offering a service, that there should be flexibility in it. I mean, not everybody wants somebody at 8:30 or 9 in the morning, because sometimes the person would like to sleep on in bed, the person who's getting the care, and it's easier for the carer. So maybe, you know, the hours need to be, they could be the middle of the afternoon would be better, and they need to be devised. But it is very much still, I'm afraid, a bit postal codey as to where you're getting your service. And if this care commission is set up, it's called a care commission for older people, but it would cover a lot of areas. And I'd like to see it based in the Taoiseach's department so that the Taoiseach of the day can call in the other departments that are relevant to providing care.
Former Justice Minister Nora Owen talking about support for carers on Today with Claire Byrne this morning. For the past week, women have been calling Liveline to give their experiences of menopause. It's been terrifying and rage-inducing to listen to what so many women have had to go through because the people entrusted with their medical care don't seem to take the menopause seriously, or in some cases seem not to know enough about it. Anne opened this afternoon's Liveline with her experience.
What age were you when you started the menopause, Anne?
I was in my 40s. I was 40. And I had my hormone levels checked with the doctor, and they confirmed that I was starting the menopause. And within the next couple of years, I went into menopause, and I just had such a bad time, just really uncomfortable in my body, and hadn't a clue really what was going on. Mm-hmm. So I went back to the doctor, and I was in bad shape when I went to the doctor. But when I went to the doctor, my normal doctor was out at the time, and he had a low come in, and I said to the doctor, I'm just a bitch. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I can't snap out of it. And I don't know what, I didn't know what was happening to me.
And what
you know?
Did you, Anne, sorry, what did you mean when you said to the doctor, I'm just a B-I-T-C-H?
I was a cranky B-I-T-C-H all the time. I just couldn't. And my family had noticed the change in me.
Yeah.
In actual fact, the morning that I said to my husband, I'm going to go to the doctor today, there's something wrong with me. He was actually lying in bed and he said, thank God, he said, because it's horrific living with you at the moment. And my husband is the most kindest, gentlest man in the world. I can't believe he's still with me. And I thank the Lord every day he has stuck by me. And when I went to the doctor, my normal doctor was out in the locum, was in, and he was an elderly man. And he held my hand and he said, well, you know, when women get older, they just like to be bitches, and let me walk out the door. It took me another 2 months to build up the courage to go back to the doctor again. And thank God my normal doctor was there. And he diagnosed me within seconds of being clinically depressed. Now, also prescribed me antidepressants, Xanax, sleeping tablets,
And I am also in recovery from an addiction. And he had no problem in giving me Xanax and sleeping tablets, which set me on a course then for the next, I came off the Xanax and sleeping tablets a few years ago because I felt like I was becoming dependent on them.
Yeah.
But they had no problem in just, like, within 2 minutes, and that was it then. I was diagnosed then as being depressed. And I remember crying to my husband that day, like, and saying, like, what else can be wrong with me? Now I have depression. And up until last week, I was driving the car home, and I was listening to your show, and I thought, what are they saying? Because something clicked in my head. And every woman on your show described my life for the last 12, 13 years.
Yeah.
Everything. And the feeling of being lost, not knowing what's going on. Why am I feeling like this? I mean, my family have just been amazing. And, you know, because I have been so cranky and like not myself, you know, and can't make a decision. You know, it's just never ending. So listening to your show last week, I couldn't believe it. I rang my daughter straight away and I was like, you need to listen to Joe Duffy. This is me. These women are me. They're talking about me. So here I am now, and I rang my doctors, but of course they're busy with COVID. I live in a rural community, and so I'm going to come off the antidepressants because I really deep down believe I don't have depression. I don't, you know, all those women last week just described absolutely everything that I've had, that I've felt for years.
And HRT.
Yeah, I'm going straight on to HRT.
Yeah.
I'm going straight on to it. I need it.
And do you mind me asking you again and to repeat what that doctor said to you? Because it seems to be, I know there's no typicality, but the doctor held your hand.
Yeah, and he said, well, you know, some women, when they get older, just like to be B-I-T-C-H-G and let me walk out the door. And it was, I remember specifically, it was the end of November. And I remember waking up that Christmas morning. I remember waking up and standing in the sitting room, and I had a beautiful tree up, and the family were coming.
Yeah.
And I thought, will I make it till 6 o'clock this evening alive? I just wanted to die. It was the lowest ebb I've ever felt in my life, and I've had many low ebbs, Joe.
Yeah.
But that, I was just talking to my daughter here, actually, and she remembers that Christmas. It was the worst Christmas. And then the confusion, well, the doctor said that you trust them. We trust these doctors.
Yeah.
So the doctor literally held my hand and said, yes, you are just a cranky, you know, whatever. And you have to get on with it.
And did he use that word, bitch?
Yes, he used it. And it took me until the end of January to get up the courage again to go back to the doctor, you know, and to my normal doctor, thanks be to God. And I did tell him, like, what happened, and he was apologising profusely. But within minutes, like, of him seeing me, he diagnosed me as clinically depressed. Like, I'm a woman in my 40s. I've never had a depression all throughout my whole history, you know. So, like, in hindsight now, like, I should have probably asked to speak to a psychiatrist. But we trust the doctors. We trust them that they're going to put us in the right place. And I actually felt kind of happy that, oh, my God, I've actually got a label. You know, it's great. But actually listening to your show last week, I should never have been labelled without, you know, a proper diagnosis, maybe, you know. Well, to be honest with you, I probably feel a little bit more lost now. I'm like, oh, what do I do? You know, but I will go back to my doctor and sit down and have a real good discussion. But I can see myself going down the route of HRT, definitely.
Yeah.
I should never have been put on antidepressants. You know, I'm 53 now.
Yeah.
I started taking antidepressants when I was 41. It's crazy. And I've gone back a few times to the doctors, and I said, I don't think these are working for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Like, there was red flags raised all along my history since I started taking them, you know, and they'd change it. They'd put me onto another one. I'd feel great then for a while I was on that one. But I probably should never have been on antidepressants in the first place. But it was an easy thing for them to diagnose me with.
That's Anne talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Live Line about her appalling experience of the menopause and the medical care that she received, which fell far short of what she might have expected. Jen Gannon joined Ryan Tuberty on the line this morning to talk about the struggle facing single people when it comes to trying to buy a home of their own. She started by telling Ryan about her own circumstances.
I'm single, and I love advertising that I'm single now. Call me. And I am a renter, and I am a freelance journalist, and I just feel that I am kind of being left behind by the housing market, and I know that a lot of people are in the same boat as me. Now, they may not be in the arts industry or sector, they may be professionals, but they also feel as a single person that the right to own a property in Ireland or even just to have stabilised rent is just something that is not happening for them.
Okay, age group, ballpark.
Ballpark, oh, the wrong side of 30. So let's say you're not enough.
Early 30s, essentially. Okay.
No, mid to late, let's say. I feel like Ketchup Luan in The Housewives.
Yeah.
Around my age.
Exactly. And I could keep going until we get the actual, but no we pinpoint exactly. So up until now, are we, in terms of trying to get a house and get a mortgage, as a single person, did you ever come close to being in a relationship with somebody enough that you nearly got a house together, or talked about it?
There was talk about it. Okay. And I think that is something when you're in a couple that it's just so much that conversation comes up a lot easier than it would when you're on your own and you're thinking, I just can't do this. It's actually impossible.
And talk to me about that impossibility.
I mean, even to be able to, you know, put together a 30,000 euro deposit, and you'd have to have a salary of over 70,000 to be able to try and do it. And I just think when you're renting and the rents are so exorbitant, it's very hard to try and just live your life and pay your rent. And at the same time, trying to save is just out of this world. It just doesn't feel like it's something that's possible for a lot of single people.
Before the pandemic, what was your house, your living arrangement?
Well, I mean, I live in an apartment by myself, but I did have roommates as well. And then they bought their own property, they're a couple, and they moved out. So I'm alone now. It's very precarious.
I understand that. Are you paying the same rent now on your own that you were paying when the three of you were there?
Yeah.
Oh, crikey. So that's put a massive hole in your finances, obviously.
Mm. And this is the thing, because I mean, a lot of people that I know that are single and they're paying this exorbitant amount of rent out every month, there is no opportunity for them to actually think about. It's just the panic every month of just having to pay your rent and bills. And that's all you're thinking of. You're just thinking of from month to month. And there really is no long-term plan for anybody, like put into place for anybody.
How common is it among the 30-somethings of modern Ireland to be in this zone?
I spoke to a friend of mine who is in a completely different industry. Like, she would be considered as a working professional and, you know, have a stable, good job, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
And she is facing the exact same fears and problems that I am having. And you're thinking, you know, to yourself, the older that you get, are you going to have to be living with other people when you're 40s and 50s and, you know, with strangers, with roommates? And it just doesn't seem like a viable situation. And it shouldn't have to be like that, you know, because you're spending thousands on rent a month and you can't get enough money together to put the deposit together. And it feels like single people have been left out of the housing conversation completely because there's such a concentration on just, and I know, don't get me wrong, it's very hard for couples themselves to buy properties in Ireland as well. I'm not saying that, but just as single people, you're never in the mix of the conversation at all, because it does feel like the government are like, you know, an old your relative saying to you, would you not ever settle down, for God's sake? You know, you're just not in that conversation at all. It's not a permanent state.
Do you feel that the government is kind of saying, you know, don't be so silly trying to buy a place on your own. Just find a nice fella or a girl or whatever you need and settle down together and sort that out?
Yeah, I do. I think there is this underlying conservatism in Irish society. I mean, we say that we're a modern society, but I do think there is this conservatism, this idea that the family is sacred and, you know, that you're some kind of overgrown teenager if you're not in a relationship and that is just not a permanent state, that you will find someone. So I do think when it comes to wanting a place on your own, they just think it's laughable, that it's not something. We don't have that European sensibility where you see somewhere like in Berlin, they have a rent freeze, which is amazing, or, you know, just to help people out to not have to pay exorbitant rents or worry about the fact that they could be turfed out tomorrow because the rent is too high or somebody wants to turn, you know, the place into an Airbnb. And I think we need that respect. It's just that little bit of dignity that single people want. They want to be part of society. Like, I don't understand why it feels like there's this stigma. There's a stigma in Ireland about renting, first of all, because it's like the scramble to get on the property ladder, which I think is insane. And I think if they made rent stabilised, that would take away some of the pressure somewhat.
Do you think there's a stigma about renting?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think the older that you get, the more it's like, have you not tried to buy somewhere, or I'm getting a mortgage, or, you know, and that's where the conversation always goes, rather than I'm renting a place, or families renting places is very, you know, people don't talk about them a lot either. And I think I really just feel that if there was an open conversation about how to actually get the renting market sorted, then I would feel a lot better as well. Long-term renting, you know, people are like to me, would you not leave Dublin? And it's like, well, why should I leave my home? Like, why is that? It's something that I would have to do. I've lived here all my life. Like, it's not a possibility that I could actually, you know, not even buy a place, but rent a place and be there long term.
But that's what the market is saying to you now, Jen. Mm. I mean, that is what the market is saying. Is that you say, but I want to live where I was brought up. I want to live where, you know, near my mother. I want to live, you know, near the sea or whatever it might be. And the market is saying, you can't afford it. You got to get out. Head down the coastline, or head to the Midland, wherever you might be more affordable. But you're out. I mean, it's not a singles friendly world when it comes to so many things in this country, but particularly the property.
Yeah, and I also think like that also begs the question: what do we want from Dublin as a city? Like, do we want it just to become a place where tourists are and where people just go to Dublin to work and then go home? Like, that's not a community. That's not the Dublin I grew up in. That's not, you know, a society. And I just feel that that's a huge issue.
Do you think that there should be some class of allowance, if you like, for single people when it comes to buying a property, let alone renting one, that gives them a little leg up when competing against couples?
I mean, I just think that we need to have proper conversations. Like, we don't, I mean, if you heard Leo Varadkar before saying, just move back in with your parents and save up, like, sure, it's grand. You know, these are not sensible opinions. Like, we need, moving back in with your parents is not a viable option for a lot of people. I mean, we can't depend on that. That's such a weird thing to say. And I just think we need to have sensible conversations around what it is like, the truth of what it is like to be a single person in Ireland trying to, you know, maybe buy a property. But like, the first thing that needs to be done is we need to regularise rent so people can actually live and people can actually afford to save a bit and then get into that conversation, you know, about buying places as well.
Makes a lot of sense. That's journalist Jen Gannon talking renting and home ownership for singletons in Ireland on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. Well, it was a fabulously sunny day in many parts of the country today, and appropriately enough, staycation reading featured on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Author Sinead Moriarty and Waterford librarian Tracy McEnany joined Claire with their recommendations. Tracy began with what Claire called comfort reads and a book called The Girl with the Louding Voice.
So I decided in lockdown I was going to try and read authors from around the world. And this is a book by Abby Dare. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And it's set in Nigeria. And it's just a gorgeous book. It's the amazing thing is it's set in modern times, although it seems like something from the dark ages. So it's a 14-year-old girl growing up in a rural Nigerian village. And she's desperate to get an education. And her mother is very keen for her to get one as well. But unfortunately, her mother dies. And her father's not interested in that. He just wants to make money. So he sells her to an older man to become his third wife to produce a son for him. But she runs away. Anyway, she gets into a bit of trouble, but she eventually ends up being a maid to a wealthy couple. And through just sheer grit and cleverness and living on her wits, she eventually meets somebody who helps her to escape and get an education. It's just wonderful. She's a very joyous character.
And you're putting that in the comfort reads category. So,
yes.
Tracy, in that vein, where are you going with comfort reads?
The comfort reads that I'm talking about is The Midnight Library. This is in all the top seller lists
at
the moment.
Oh, yeah, it's at the top of all the lists I see every weekend.
It's very, very good. I read it on the Borrowbox app on e-audiobook. My mother is now listening to it, right? It's about Nora. She's a 30-something year-old woman who has a lot of regrets in life. She feels unloved, unneeded in this world, and she wants to end her life, right? But she does end her life. Barely. And she lands in the Midnight Library. And the Midnight Library is a place between life and death. And in this Midnight Library, she can pick out books that her life, variations on her life. So she was going to marry a guy called Dan. She didn't. So she can then try out that life. And if she finds a life that she really, really likes, she can actually choose to stay in that life, right? But this audiobook...
Complicated. This sounds very complicated.
Oh, not at all. It would make a great film. And actually, it has been optioned for a film by Studio Canal and Blueprint Pictures, right? And Matt Haig is supposed to executive produce. But this audiobook, right, is read by Carey Mulligan, the actress. She reads it so brilliantly. It's a just a lovely, lovely book.
Yeah, I watched A Promising Young Woman. Have you
brilliant.
Seen it?
She's phenomenal.
She's fabulous. Highly recommend that one as well. A page turner this time, Sinead, The Mothers.
Yeah, The Mothers is by Britt Bennett. She's probably slightly better known for her book The Vanishing Half, which won quite a lot of awards. The Mothers, I think, is equally good. Again, total page turner. It's a book about the entangled lives of three teens. They live in a very tight-knit, sort of curtain-twitching, judgmental African-American community in California. And then, so you have Nadia, whose mother's recently committed suicide. You've got Aubrey, whose mother has chosen her boyfriend over her. And then you've Luke, the pastor's son. And it's about jealousy, young love, personal demons, betrayal, and how they all grow up and find out that they still long for what they left behind.
Okay, so that's you're putting that in which category now again?
Comfort read, page turner.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And back to you then, Tracy. Let's talk about thrillers. And I know you're a big fan of Liz Nugent. We all are here, I think.
We are definitely. Asher, any Liz Nugent book is actually brilliant. But one book that I came across, this was Northern Spy by Flynn Berry. It was Reese Witherspoon's book of the month in April, right? It's a spy thriller. It's about two sisters that are becoming entangled with the IRA. Tessa is a producer in the Belfast Bureau of the BBC, and she's at work one day. News of a raid, another raid comes in, and at the same time, a robbery takes place at a gas station. Now, the robbery is supposed to be done by her sister Marion, but who they think has joined the IRA. But has she? Has she not? It's about family, terror, motherhood, and it will just be a very, very good read. But also,
will you just give me the name of that one again? Because I know people will want to.
It's Northern Spy by Flynn Berry, but it was Reese Witherspoon's book of the month.
Okay, so which means it'll fly off every shelf in every country around the world.
Absolutely. Oh, and another thing, just what I think of it, right? A book that's going to be flying off the shelves and that is available on our Borrowbox app is Conversation with Friends. This is Sally Rooney's book. The filming has just started this week in Belfast and Dublin and other locations. And as like in normal people, it'll be hard to get this book, but it is available on our ebook. Now, another book that is a page turner that we love, Joe Spain. And Joe Spain has a new book out. This is Erin Kennedy. She thinks she has the perfect life, like us all, I suppose. She's married to detective husband David until one morning they get a knock on the door from his colleagues. And when the knock on the door comes, David jumps out of the window of the fourth floor apartment.
And on it goes from there,
right? Absolutely. Yeah, but it's very, very, it sounds really good. Erin, the wife, is charged with the murder 18 months later. It's told in various timelines, and I'd say it'll be another one, another good one from Joe Spain.
I'm reading a book called Holding Her Breath by Emer Ryan. I don't know if you've come across this one. It's such a great page turner. I got home from work at 12:30 last night and started reading it, knowing that I had to be up early this morning. It's a really good read. Ooh, I'm not at the end yet, so I don't know what happens, but that's what I'll be doing later on this afternoon if I get a few minutes to myself. Where are we going next, Sinead?
Well, another one I'd like to recommend is Unorthodox. And a lot of people watched the series on Netflix.
Yes, watched it myself, yeah.
Yeah, so it's about sort of the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in Brooklyn. But the Netflix series was based on the original book by Deborah Feldman, who fled. It's autobiographical. And the book is actually even better because you get all that detail and that colour and that layering. It's a kind of just a fascinating insight into the world of this ultra-Orthodox community in Brooklyn and how the author escaped from its clutches. And just it goes into the kind of detail of how badly women are treated in this society. Mm-hmm. They don't believe in educating women because what's the point? And it's just absolutely fascinating. So that's a real gripping one now, I recommend.
And then if you're looking at what you're going to read over the summer, Tracy, it might be a good time to find a series of books that you're interested in, so you can just do, you know, maybe one after the other over the coming months.
The series of books. Now, if you're not a Jeffrey Archer a fan, don't worry, you will like this. This is the Clifton Chronicles. It's a family saga. Then you've got Lucinda Riley. This is the Seven Sisters series. Huge, big tomes, but will keep you reading from through the summer and beyond. Then you've got Anna Jacobs. She's got several series. And then you've got Robert Galbraith. He is the author of The Cuckoo Calling. But the Unorthodox, thank you very much, is on our e-audiobook. And it's about, you'll be listening to that for about 11 hours.
Yeah, have people really taken to that, Tracy?
They love it. Mm. I love it because I'm a slow reader. I am going, you can go down the prom in Tramore on your staycation. You're going to have a smile on your face. You're going to be listening to a free e-audio book via your local library. And if you're not a member of your local library, you can join your local library, but you can take out a book in Donegal or you can take it out a book in Tramore and bring it back to whatever library you're staycationing in. It's just, and another thing, if you're visiting a small little town and it doesn't have a tourist office, go into your local library because we have all the information in there.
You know everything in the library. Yeah.
Someone needs to keep an eye on those librarians going around knowing everything. That's Waterford librarian Tracy McEnany and author Sinead Moriarty talking about staycation books to read or listen to when you manage to get away this summer. The full list of the books is available on the Today with Claire Byrne page on rte.ie. That theft of ducklings we heard about earlier on the Ryan Tuberty show was further explored on this afternoon's Ray Darcy show when Ray spoke to Birdwatch Ireland's Niall Hatch. But first, as must happen to Niall every time his name and his job are mentioned in the same sentence, Ray wanted to indulge in some nominative determinism conversation.
A friend of mine had a urologist named Dr. Flood. There was also a meteorologist named Amy Freeze in the US and Andrew Drinkwater of the Water Research Centre in the UK. I kid you not, says Gráinne in Ennis. All victims of nominative determinism, as is our next guest, Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland. How are you doing, Niall?
I'm very good, right? Story of my life, the old nominative determinism.
Yes. So have you read about nominative determinism? Have you done research on it?
Oh, I have. Yes. And there might be something in it. Because what I always point out when people say, obviously, your name is Hatch and you work with Birdwatch Ireland, I should say hello to my former and present colleagues, Olivia Crow. We have Donald Finch. We have Steve Wing, who's our warden at Cape Clare Bird Observatory. And his predecessor was honestly a guy called Dave Bird. So there's a few people in it together.
Right, okay. Yeah. Of course, there are people with those names who never went near a bird in their lives. You know, so that's the other thing.
It's sort of what we call confirmation bias. You notice it when people have it. But maybe for an organisation like Birdwatch Ireland, quite a small staff, maybe there is something to it.
I love confirmation bias. I'm fascinated by it. Anyway, that's for another day. Today we're talking about ducklings. And we heard Gillian Bird on Morning Ireland this morning. So people are taking, it appears, ducklings out of the canal and selling them for a fiver because there's some sort of TikTok social media craze about owning ducklings. So what do we know about ducklings? It's their time of year, obviously, isn't it?
It is. This is the time when we see the ducklings in the parks and in the canals and in the rivers. And this current trend is quite worrying because the ducklings, of course, need to be in the wild. They need to be looked after by their mothers. It's very important that they do that. So I was really shocked to hear this story. I first heard it yesterday. It was just too late for us to mention it on last night's Mooney Goes Wild programme, but you know, it's something I'm sure we'll return to on that as well, because it really is very serious. Mm. It is a criminal offence for people to take ducklings, and of course it's also a death sentence for those ducklings, because they're wild animals, they need to be looked after by their parents. They've quite an unusual breeding biology in that, you know, for most birds in our gardens, let's say blackbirds and robins and birds like that, the mum and the dad play a role in looking after the chicks. With the ducklings, it's only their mother who looks after them. The father has no role whatsoever in caring for his offspring. So it all comes down to mum, and they really need mum's protection in order to be able to survive. So when they're taken away from their mother, they won't live for very long, unfortunately. It's very cruel, really.
Okay, can I just go back to the criminal offence?
Yes.
Just before we carry on. So how so is it a criminal offence?
So under the Wildlife Acts of 1976 to 2018, it's actually an offence for anybody to capture a wild bird of any kind without a licence from the National Parks and Wildlife Service. It's also an offence to interfere with the nests or with the young of any wild bird that's protected by law. So that includes mallards and other duck species within Ireland, because this, the duck involved here is a species called the mallard.
Right.
So from that point of view, it is a crime for people to take these from the wild under the Wildlife Acts, and it's also a crime for people to sell them for people to possess them without a license. So,
right, that's
so
hugely important that people know that now, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And, you know, we have a real problem in Ireland with wildlife crime. There's lots of blind eyes turned here and there to basically people exploiting our wildlife in illegal ways. And so just to stress this to people, this is completely illegal. When birds are taken from the wild like this, that is a criminal offence.
And it's a criminal offence at every stage in the chain.
Yes, it is. So whether you're the person capturing them, the person selling them, the person buying them, the person even who would give them for free to somebody, that is a criminal offence.
Okay. So we're talking about mallards. Now, how many would they have in a, what is it called, a clutch, or what is it?
A clutch, absolutely. Yeah. So what they do is they would have normally around a dozen. It can be anywhere from 10 up to maybe about 14. They have, they're quite big clutches or big broods. And they have also a very interesting habit whereby some of the females will lay their eggs in the nests of other mallards just to sort of spread their genetic inheritance around a little bit, so that it's not all the eggs in one basket or in one nest. So in some way, the cuckoos sort of do that. The mallards do it as well. But of course, what happens is when the young hatch out, they're already able to look after themselves quite well from day one in terms of finding their own food. They still need their mother to watch out for danger, to keep them away from predators, to show them how to find food, but they feed themselves straight away. So it's quite a long incubation period. And that's actually one of the reasons why they were one of the first animals to be domesticated by people. Because what happens is the chicks that are very well developed when they come out of the egg, we call them precocious, meaning very advanced.
Right.
They tend to have the largest yolks in their eggs because they need to stay in the egg longer so that they grow to a more developed state. And they were the ones that were domesticated because those eggs were more nutritious. So another good example of that would be chickens. That's exactly the same reason. So the ducklings are fully responsible for finding their own food from day one. Their eyes are open. They're swimming within a few hours of coming out of the egg, but they still need their mother to look after them.
Okay. How many ducklings are we talking about, you know, say on the canal?
Well, obviously on the canal, there's quite a few stretches. You'd often have them between the locks there. So there would be at least several dozen breeding females there along the canals. You'd have other ones coming in. Sometimes the ducklings get separated from the mothers when they're a bit older. So you'd be talking several hundred at least along the canal.
Okay. Are they easy to catch?
In some cases they would be, especially when they're very young, because they tend not to really understand much about danger. And for people who are using nets or whatever, they might find that relatively easy. What we'd say is obviously that would happen usually in very public areas. So if people see that happening, please do call the Gardaí, call the National Parks and Wildlife Service, call the city authorities. It's really important that this kind of crime is reported.
Okay, the gruesome stuff then. So what's likely to happen then if somebody has got a duckling, they've brought it home? First of all, they've separated from their mother and their siblings. They're out of their natural habitat. So what happens? What do you think?
So what will happen in most cases is that, first of all, this duckling, it will experience stress, even if it's not clear that that's what's happening to it. It's out of its natural environment. It's not reacting the way that it normally would. It's missing its mother. They have this very strong bond. They imprint on their mother from the second they come out of the egg. They'll follow the first creature that they see, which in most cases is their mother. So when you see captive ducks that are reared in captivity, they've often imprinted on a human being. So they almost think of themselves as being human and they'll follow them. That's not the case for wild ducklings. They'll be pining for their mothers. Obviously, people may not mean any harm, but they won't be able to feed this bird successfully.
Niall Hatcher of Birdwatch Ireland talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon about the recent spate of what they're calling duck nappings in Dublin. Moving on after loss can be a difficult and painful process for many people. The topic was discussed on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne, as Claire was joined by Sinead Hingston whose husband Jeff died suddenly in 2011, and by Liz Gleason, a grief psychotherapist. Sinead started by telling Claire how she lost Jeff on a holiday in Portugal.
I mean, it just was so sudden and ridiculous. Like, when I think back now, it still seems very unreal. But we decided the morning that all the parents were leaving that we'd go out on one of the organised boat trips along the Algarve coast and just to see the caves. And we took off from Villamora Marina, and it was just a stunning day. And they anchored eventually kind of just outside the caves, I suppose, just away from the caves. And the captain said, look, anyone who wants to jump in for a swim while you're waiting for the dinghy to come out of the caves with the first set of people, you're more than welcome to. So initially, Jeff wasn't going to jump in. And, you know, I kind of flagged him a little bit and I was like, you're going to regret it. Like, he was such a water baby. I was like, just go for a swim. You know, look where we are. You know, we're in heaven. Just go for it. And he was worried that he'd have to sit on the dinghy with wet shorts on. And I said, you'll dry in 2 seconds. Like, go on, jump in. So, yeah, he jumped in. He swam around very happily for 5 or 6 minutes and kind of, you know, took loads of photographs of him in the water. And then I took my eyes off him for about 40 seconds. And whatever happened in that 40 seconds, when I look back, he was struggling to breathe and he was lying on his back and just had his, you know, mouth open. And he was really struggling to catch a breath from what I could see. And I was shouting his name and he wasn't responding. And yeah, then he just went limp. That was him.
What do you think happened?
The autopsy was very vague. The official cause of death was accidental drowning, but we all kind of believe that he was stung by a jellyfish and just went into anaphylactic shock and had some sort of seizure. So yeah, it was very vague and they didn't do a lot of the tests. You know, they deemed it unnecessary expenses and it was very hard trying to deal with.
And you're there pregnant. You were about 20 weeks at that stage, were you?
I was 19 weeks. Yeah, and she came exactly 19 weeks to the day later. So, but yeah, 19 weeks pregnant. And I mean, yeah, like your whole world goes from absolutely heavenly to turned upside down in an instant. You know, we were renting in the UK. We didn't have a house. You know, we didn't have a mortgage to be paid off by insurance. We didn't have life insurance. We just got married 7 months before. So we were still kind of in the process of sorting all of those important things out when you get married and you start a family. So we really had, you know, a little bit of savings that we had. And it was just, yeah, I can't even describe the feeling of fear that hits you when it's just so unexpected, you know, you just can't catch your breath.
And then you moved home then, is that what you did?
Yeah, so we were renting in the UK, but there's no way I could have afforded to stay, and being pregnant as well, it wasn't suitable. So I actually went home from Portugal. Went home to Dublin from Portugal, and obviously the funeral happened that weekend. And then we went back, myself and my mum went back over maybe, I think it was about 2 weeks after the funeral, to pack up the house. I have to say, like, the person I was renting from in the UK was just the most understanding human in the world. Like, he was like, take your time whenever you're ready to come back over, you know, just don't worry about it. So we went back over and packed up our life into boxes and hoped to God the delivery truck arrived and was meant to, and then I went back home. So back in with mum and dad at 30 years old and pregnant with a dog.
Gosh, I just, I mean, I assume for you, everybody around you was saying, oh, you've got to look after yourself, you've got to look after your baby. But how difficult was it to bear in mind that you've got to try and keep your mind and body healthy through all of this?
It was like a form of torture. Like, I just remember one day, you know, sitting by his grave. Sorry, I'm going to get emotional. And, you know, you're heavily pregnant and you're heaving, crying. And in the back of your mind, you're like, think of the baby. And I didn't want to have to think of the baby. I just wanted to grieve for Jeff. I wanted to just be able to cry when I needed to cry. I couldn't eat very much. I remember living on brioche. It was the only thing that I could actually stomach at the time. And I just remember, like, the guilt. And, you know, you have this whole other wave of guilt going on because you're trying to look after this tiny thing in your stomach, and at the same time you feel guilty because you're not freely able to grieve for, you know, your husband who you've just lost. But I remember I went to the psychiatrist in Hollis Street all through the second half of my pregnancy, and I don't know where I'd be for him. He was just so incredible. He just said, look, you know, your baby's going to be fine. You know, you need to be able to you need to be able to grieve and not have to worry about this. Like, this baby will live off you and will thrive off you and your body. So you just need to focus on your own grief and stop worrying about this little tiny thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was all just very surreal, you know. You feel like you're living in this bubble, and there's people rallying around you, and you genuinely want the world to just stop turning just for a little while, just so you can get your head around it. I remember walking through Dundrum shopping centre at one stage, and you know, it is the weirdest feeling walking through a shopping centre, really busy, really, you know, vibrant, full of life, people chatting and laughing, and you just want to scream, can you just stop? My husband's just died. Like, do none of you know that my husband, like, you know, what I'm going through? And it really was, you know, the hardest lesson to learn. You really have no idea what somebody is going through.
Yeah, I might bring Liz in at this point. Liz Gleeson, grief psychotherapist. Liz, thanks for being with us today. Good morning. Is that a common theme in the people that you deal with and the experience that they've been through? You're going through something so profound and so deeply shocking that it's such a shock to you that the rest of the world then can continue operating.
Absolutely. And Sinead, just to say, very sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Grief can be so utterly brutal. And unless you've lost somebody who's very close to you, people really don't understand. Like, it affects us on a physical level, an emotional level, psychologically, spiritually. It is so deeply personal and isolating and lonely. It's like a nuclear explosion has gone off in your system and nobody else knows what's going on inside you. Very, very lonely. And, you know, people give platitudes and try to help. And a lot of these platitudes are euphemisms. You know, you'll get better with time, or you stay strong. They only serve to isolate the grieving person even more. Because very few people can actually sit with the rawness of grief. You know, really just accompany someone and allow them to have the depth and breadth of the expression of grief that they need to have. So people find themselves, you know, like Sinead described there, just in their own little surreal world, unreachable sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And Sinead, can you just bring us through what happened then? You know, your baby is born. How did all that go for you? How did you cope in the early months after her birth?
So I mean, I could write a book and people actually wouldn't believe it. I didn't have the easiest delivery with Lily. So I had a lot of recovery after it. I was in and out having various different procedures done. So I had her. She was born on the 11th of December, so she was 2 weeks early. And I had more surgery the following March. So it wasn't until the July or August, which was Jeff's first anniversary of the following year, that I finally got the all clear from having Lily. So there was a lot of bitterness. There was a lot of anger, you know, a lot of shouting at people saying, like, why is this happening to me? You know, why couldn't the delivery just have been smooth sailing and I could concentrate on trying to be a mom, but I couldn't sit. You know, I had to lie down on my side because I was so, there was just a lot of issues after having her. And also navigating motherhood, living with your parents, you know, which was, I have to say, again, incredible. I don't know where I'd be without them. But you're 30 years old, you know, you're meant to be experiencing this new life with your husband. And it was just the most bittersweet feeling of elation and devastation all mixed into one. And there's nothing in life that can prepare you for these feelings.
That's Sinead Hingston, whose husband Jeff died in 2011, and who, along with grief psychotherapist Liz Gleeson, joined Claire Byrne to discuss moving on after loss. It'd be well worth your while listening to the entire discussion on the RTE radio player. Well, that's it for this edition of Playback Daily. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And there'll be another edition of Playback Daily tomorrow at the same time. But for me, Neil O'Sheridan, thank you for listening and good luck.